June 2nd, 2006, Karen Saul speaking. I'm here with Frank Bauman to continue his oral history. We're in the Standard Plaza building, and we just had a little technical difficulties with the last tape, but I'm going to double check that we have a good recording on this, and then I'll let you pick up that story where you left off.
Well, that little difficulty permits me to make a correction here. I was in error. I said foreign secretary, and it was the foreign minister, the member of the cabinet, who was speaking to Mr. Ambassador Page and conferring with him. And he informed Page that the decision of Parliament to declare war against Germany was solely based on the breaking of a treaty, and you raised this point, Consul, earlier, the breaking of a treaty by the European powers guaranteeing the neutrality of Belgium. State created, what, about 1810 or 20? And that breach of international law was felt so fundamental by the British, and particularly the members of Parliament, that Britain would respond to that German invasion, and above all, the breach of the treaty, by declaring war against Germany. And that is in the record. At the same, and I apologize, I cannot remember the name of that foreign minister, I have it, but I do remember the statement he made at that time, and it was this, quote, "The lights in Europe are going out one by one, and we shall never see them lit again in our time." Close quote. Rather providential statement.
I haven't studied international law myself, but I'm curious if you can explain what differences are there, if any, between a contract that you might form with another party just here in the U.S. versus a treaty between countries. Are they more or less the same?
There's parallels, Consul. Very, very sound question, very legalistic question. But there are differences too. And I've already, in a sense, touched on this without anticipating the question that you're asking at this time. And that is that the treaty is the paramount source of international law. Basically, there are three sources of international law: treaties, principles of the law, like we touched upon, freedom of the seas, and customs accepted over a period of time by an indefinite number of civilized or responsible nations. The latter, the third example, sometimes challenge. Principles, I think, stand, and certainly treaties do. But you have bilateral treaties, just as you have bilateral contracts. In other words, two states a party to the treaty. You have multilateral treaties where several states are involved, just as you have several peoples making a contract, and both have the element of promise and performance, which we call in the contractual world consideration. But the influence of treaties in the system of international law, I would be bold enough to suggest, might be possibly more significant than contracts, although contracts in our world under the common law are extremely important, but they are parallel by the common law system where you have a judge-made law. And I would be hesitant to say that in the international law arena that you have judge-made law. You're basically a judge is trying to enforce a treaty or to enforce a principle of international law, a judge, or generally, like there are 15 judges on the International Court of Justice of The Hague, it's a multiplicity of judges making the decision. Let me get a drink of water here, please. Well, first and foremost, the experience gave me a fundamental knowledge of international law as interpreted by the English or British teaching system led by Dr. Schwarzenberger, whom I've mentioned. And this has remained with me and was a special force and influence during my years with the UN system in Australasia. It's with me today as I talk to you at this time. I've discovered over the years in returning to the United States and being largely in this country except for the Australasian years that there is an inability in the United States among its citizenry to accept international law as a living force in the conduct of state upon state relationships, which is unfortunate. And there's evidence of this as recently as a few weeks ago when I believe it was the Attorney General in London commented about certain decisions made at the Washington level in connection with the Iraq War that were contrary to our traditions. And I, by my statement at this time, could be breaches of international law, namely the violation of the treatment of prisoners under the Geneva treaties. This is an influence that remains with me. Above all, or I shouldn't say above all, a contemporaneous element that left with me and returned to the States was my respect for the English parliamentary system and the average English or British citizen. I know when I left London with Mildred on June 18th, 1952, and we were going by train from London down to Southampton to catch our Holland America ship, the New Amsterdam. As I thought about the departure, I thought I should and did want to return to my home country, but I was in a sense almost in tears leaving the country.
There's been a debate recently about our U.S. Supreme Court in the U.S. With regard to how much deference it should give to international law in making decisions. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that subject.
Well, I'm not truly an expert on that, but I do have thoughts based on my experience, based on having served as an adjunct professor of international law, and above all based on my year of study in London and my experience in the UN. But having said that, I'm aware of what you are saying, and I think a defender of the faith, so to speak, has been our first lady Supreme Court Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, who has been in the forefront nationally speaking on this very question, encouraging courts. She has led the publication of a handbook distributed by the American Society of International Law to our judiciary around the country, reminding it of the role of international law historically in the decision-making process of the court system. I mentioned the Antelope case to you earlier today, the decision by Justice Marshall. I think that's about 1818 or 1820. International law is a subject that was with us at the beginning of the country in 1789. It was present at the Constitutional Convention of 1787. If you read James Madison's journal of that convention, he cites international law and how the delegates respected international law, calling it not international law at that time, but the law of nations. And it's an attitude, it's a quasi-spiritual commitment that's tended to escape so many of those, some of them in positions of great influence in recent years. Do I make myself clear?
I think it might be a good time then to wrap up today when we begin again, and we'll pick a date here when we're finished with the tape. We'll start with your trip back to the United States in 1952 and what happened after that.
All right, and I compliment you and thank you, Consul, for your questions. They wake me up a bit and they cause me to reflect. And I'm reaching back to years that are some time back, but I've enjoyed the 2 hours with you. I thank you.
Good. Thank you.
This is Karen Saul speaking. It is June 15th, 2006, and I'm here with Frank Bauman in the Standard Insurance Building to continue his oral history today. And I'm going to just test and make sure we have good recording quality.
Good morning, Consul Saul. I'm delighted to see you again. And I understand from your statement earlier that we will take up time-wise, chronologically, or in chronological order, returning from England in June of 1952, and what happened next? good morning again, Consul. I have with me today a number of pictures related to, for photos related to my practice. I'm holding in my hand, and they've been marked as exhibits, thanks to Consul Saul. Let's take the first number and proceed in sequence here. Would you want to give me the number, and I'll identify it briefly?
The first one is 0036.
Thank you. This is a picture, I believe, taken in Washington, D.C., at a meeting sponsored by the American Society of International Law, possibly its annual meeting. And it's a portrait of a number of lawyers sitting around the table, foreign and domestic. Principally, at the rear is Harold Stanton, one-time governor of the state of Mississippi, and a Republican candidate for President of the United States. And I'm on the far right with a bow tie on.
This is 0037.
I point out that the gentleman in front is the eminent former mayor of Portland, Terry Schrunk, And on his right is Wendell Gray, president of Multnomah County Bar Association. And on his left is Mr. Sparkman, whose name eludes me at the moment. And I'm directly behind the mayor, and I suspect that this covers a brief meeting on Multnomah County Bar activities, maybe related to the period when the world Committee on International Law was active, seeking ways and means to strengthen international law to prevent war and maintain the peace.
Were you active with the Multnomah County Bar at times?
Moderately, but I was chairman of that particular committee, the state bar, in fact, its first chairman.
This is 0038.
That would be rather early on, maybe in the 50s. This is a picture of yours truly by Fabian Bachreit, B-A-C-H-R-A-C-H, and it was done in Washington, D.C., I would say sometime about 1964-65, well-known photographer.
And this is 0039.
And this is a rather older photo of Frank Baumann as ensign in the United States Navy, taken apparently in the summer of 1943.
And finally we have 0040.
This is a later scene. I'm shaking hands, having the privilege, with Sir Keith Holyoake, Prime Minister of New Zealand. Picture was taken on November 10th, 1971, in connection with my duties as the senior representative of the United Nations in that part of the world. And undoubtedly, at that time, I think I was presenting to the PM a book that had been recently published by the High Commissioner of Refugees, setting forth its accomplishments from its original treaty period, creating the High Commissioner, which I think was around 1951 or 52, but this would be 20 years later, probably the 20th anniversary of the work of the High Commissioner of Refugees and his colleagues. Extraordinary organization.
So yes, the photograph says it was taken on November 10, 1971. And then you've brought some other materials here, and I wanted you to explain what they are and where you anticipate keeping them in case someone should want to see them later.
I have a number of law materials in front of me, chronologically related. They begin in September 1949, when I first was employed after law school completion in June of 49. By the firm of McGuire, Shields, Morrison, and Bailey in the Piddock Block, which still exists under another name. And they're on 6 months schedules, beginning the fall of 49, spring of 1950, then fall of 1951, which would be related to my change of position to Wilbur Beckett, Oppenheimer, Motz, and Souther. Largely memorandums to Mr. Bob Motz, who was in charge of the trial department and to whom I was primarily responsible, and to a lesser extent, Mr. Gene Oppenheimer, later became a circuit judge, who was also deeply involved in trial work, and to a degree with Mr. Calvin Souther, who headed the corporate and business department of the firm. They carry on into the spring of 1950. And into the fall of 1951, briefly, before I adjourned to the University of London to study international law. I say fall, I notice on the dates they're largely in July and August of 1951. Quite a number, there must be 15 or so there.
And are these with your personal papers in your
Good
home?
Question, very fundamental question, Consul. Thank you for asking it. These papers I keep in my personal records in my storage room at my apartment at 2323 Southwest Park Place, the Park Vista Apartments, Portland 97205.
And you have other diaries and things. Do you want to explain?
I would prefer, Consul, as we get into my return to the States after the year, or roughly 1 year in England and the continent, that these be identified and marked, and that they relate to, hopefully, to answering questions that you might want to put to me. The first is a log that I'm holding. If you would mark it, and I'll let you.
We'll mark this 0041.
Thank you.
And I'm going to put the sticker on the back,
mm-hmm.
in the lower corner here. Hopefully it'll stay on there. It's kind of a...
Do you want some scotch tea? Let me get some scotch tape to make sure.
We can do that later.
All right.
I'll come back and get the tape on if we think we need it.
I'm holding exhibit number 0041, and we'll at least identify it now if we may. And this is a log on an alphabetical basis of legal subjects that I faced and sought to surmount for my principals, beginning with the Mont Souther era. I'm indebted to Judge Gene Oppenheimer in this respect, because he suggested that I keep this index A through Z, and it relates to memorandums I wrote for Mont Souther, and it also relates to my time in London under Dr. George Schwarzenberger, studying international law, and to memorandums that I submitted to Dr. Schwarzenberger and his supporting faculty at the University of London.
It's organized, it looks like, by topic, alphabetically.
Yes. Well, let's take the several examples. When you turn to the last page on agency, there's a memorandum on agency in Stanfield versus Karen Knitting Company, which was in federal court here in the United States District of Court. A article on arthritis that I wrote in June 1, 1953, which after I'd returned to the United States and had begun self-practice in the Morgan Building at 633 Morgan Building. I suspect here's something on aggravation of damages of pre-existing ailments. Note again, June 1st, 1953, when I was in individual practice. Then moving along, let us take a look at B briefly. Here we have four examples on one page. There's others on B, bills and notes, consideration as a personal defense between parties. See memo to Robert T. Motz, August 9th, 1951, broker. In the insurance matter, agent as agent of insurer or general agent where broker takes premiums for his own use. Memo to Calvin N. Souther, August 22nd, 1951. Here's something on bill of exchange. Effect of drawer issuing a stop payment order. Note to Robert T. Motz, August 30th, 1951. Bills and notes. See Supra. Note to Robert T. Motz, August 30th, 1951. Barter. And then here we go back to London again, agreements in East European countries, post-war papers for Dr. Schwarzenberger, see memo, etc. File, fall 1951, page 52, London, March 20th, 1952. Then,
you were very well organized, I'll say.
I tried to be. We have to be in the law, don't you agree?
Yes. Pardon? People now rely on computers so much.
Which assists them mightily. Assists them, but they didn't have computers then.
I understand. So this is a loose-leaf notebook where you essentially tried to keep track of things that you had analyzed and written on, so that you would not have to go recreate the wheel, as we say, each time?
Right, exactly. Here we move on to C, and I don't want to gild the lily in this respect, but on this particular page on C, here's corporations, who is entitled to possession custody of corporate records, judicial remedies to acquire same, memorandum to Mr. Oppenheimer, August 19th, 1950. And then I'm going to turn on here, if I may. Then here we go back to the period when I'm starting to practice by myself, although it was written, in foreign corporations. When is a foreign corporation doing business within a jurisdiction sufficiently to be served with process? Memorandum in Stanfield versus Karen Nitti. Let me add a little humor to this. In Stanford versus Stanfield, S-T-A-N-F-I-E-L-D, in that case, I inherited from the Mott's office, and they let me take it on, and maybe they were wise in turning it over to me because we ultimately lost. I want to be perfectly candid, but it was in federal court before the famous Judge James Alger Fee, and the defendant challenged the filing of the complaint on the grounds of the corporation was not doing business in the state of Oregon, therefore was not subject under diversity of citizenship to be sued in the federal court system in Oregon. But before we reached that stage, I felt I should go back to Chicago and see if possibly we could sue them in Illinois, because Karen Knitting was an Illinois corporation and its factory was in Illinois. And the factual question in that case related to wool that it had committed to buy from Mr. Stanfield, my client, and then with the settlement, with the Korean War winding down, the price of wool fell drastically.
Were they using wool for uniforms?
Not so. I don't know what they were using, but they were in the wool business in terms of turning it into cloth. And so they backed out of the contract they had with Mr. Stanfield. So I went back by train. At the same time, this was in a glorious period, at least in terms of what I thought I could do in the law, was to engage in a political life at the same time I was practicing. And I was serving as chairman, this would be in the spring of 1953, of a statewide meeting of the Democratic Party in Portland. Eventually some 600 Democrats gathered, and I had to put this all together, and I had to have a speaker. And meeting was to arouse public support for Dick Neuberger, who eventually was, in 1954, elected the United States Senator, Richard L. Neuberger. And I was going back to Chicago, and unrelated to the political matter, and I went back on the old Empire Builder and arrived in Chicago, and went up to the law firm, which was the old Pam Hurd and Reichman firm, which was then Schiff, Hardin and Waite, and had a meeting scheduled with the principal trial lawyer. I was waiting in the conference room, but let me back up a moment, if I may, please. Before leaving Portland, I had had a put together a list of distinguished Democrats who had rejected my invitation. And so, in desperation before leaving, I sent out about a dozen letters all over the country to various Democrats, and these ranged from former President Truman, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mr. Farley, the post office, postal head of the cabinet in the Roosevelt years, etc., some senators. Anyway, I'm back in Chicago. I'm in the conference, not in the conference room, in the waiting room, hoping to see this gentleman shortly. And I hear over the paging system Senator Jackson calling Mr. Bauman. Senator Jackson calling Mr. Bauman. There were about six people in the lobby then, or in the waiting area, and they look up at me wondering who he is. And the receptionist says, well, you can take the call over here. So I adjourn and I take the call in the booth. And the first thing Senator Jackson says to me when I get on the phone, good morning, Senator, is what the H is going on in Oregon? And I said, what do you mean by that, sir? And I said, well, he said, you have invited me to address this meeting in Portland, and you've also invited my fellow senator in Washington to address it too. And I'll be honest with you, I can't.